Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, starting the show today by taking a look at the lack of cannabis laws in our state today and learn a bit and zero in on the differences between cannabis and marijuana with our first guest, Philip Scott. Phil is head of the Wisconsin Hemp Manufacturers and the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers, that's the correct title, and is also co-owner of Crone Apothecary in Madison. And as we visit with Phil, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. What concerns do you have about the lack of laws? Have you used these products and a reaction to it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Phil, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
No, thanks for having me on, Larry.
Let's start by just talking about your background a bit. You've been doing this for a bit across a wide range of things relating to cannabis.
A little background. I started real heavily in 2014 when Colorado and the U.S. federal government kind of said, let's create a pilot program for research. So I traveled out west, did a little research while working at UPS. And then I got hurt on the job in about 2016 and realized I got to do change of life here. So I realized there's a lot of new things coming. And in 2017, 2018, decided to fire up the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association, or abbreviation to make it easy for us, just WIFMA. Yeah. WIHFMA, and from there we've just been guiding legislation and educating people and trying to make change.
And you're involved in kind of all aspects of this, are you not? I mean, you're a farmer too.
Yeah, I farm it, I process it, produce it, basically anything vertically integrated seed to shelf, and try to take our knowledge that we're learning and push that out into the community. But one thing I do want to say, I hope by the end of this show today that we changed that misconception in our industry that it is the Wild West, because it's not.
Yeah. How much hemp is grown in Wisconsin? Do we know?
It ranges. So we've went from, in 2018, we went from 288 hemp farmers to, in 2019, almost 1,800 hemp farmers. You know, and the USDA doesn't give us the hemp farmers that are out there, but speaking to the local agents and things and the local FSAs, we probably have about 600 or 700 registered licenses in our state, and I can't vouch that they all actually use them.
Yeah. Well, here we have the sale and possession of marijuana being illegal in Wisconsin, yet residents can pretty readily find for sale products that contain psychoactive ingredients similar to what is in marijuana. How the heck is that possible?
Well, it's a long story, but I think the shorter version is in 2018 and 2020, we had the farm bills change. In 2020's farm bill, they left it very open-ended and interpreted based off the dry weight basis on below 0.3 total THC. So us hemp farmers, we got together and go, well, our CBD flower is really struggling to sell. What can we do? And the industry got together and they started figuring out all the minor cannabinoids and everything that went beyond CBD. And that's kind of where we've gotten to where we are today. So in 2020, the state of Wisconsin turned over their state-run hemp program to the federal government. And the federal government bases their hemp program with the USDA off the U.S. Farm Bill. And that Farm Bill has opened up this doorway that we have today, where you have these products that are on the shelf that may be considered unregulated. And right now, we can move those type of products into 43 U.S. territories legally. 7 or 8 of them have banned them.
So the marijuana, I mean, the cannabis and marijuana here, let's just talk about the difference. And you're getting at it here a bit, but it's sort of the same plant, isn't it?
Yes. It is the same plant. You know, we have a variety that will produce high minor cannabinoids, such as like your THCA, your CBNs, your CBDs, your CBGs. And then you have its cousin or sister strain that's just been bred up to have high quantity THC in it. Basically, they are the same plant. They're just bred to do different things.
So did you do a bit of that breeding yourself, or have you relied on just others?
Well, it's a tricky thing. So there's, when we first started, we did have to import seed and things like that, but we started vertically integrating seed from out west with our feral hemp that's been growing here since the early 20s.
Yeah.
And working with the universities on varietal trials and crossbreedings and things like that, it's a very interesting platform. You know, we still have some farmers that are paying $1 to $5 a seed when we know we could produce this seed for less than 50 cents a seed.
Yeah. I was thinking back, I can remember when I was quite a bit younger, someone stopping at the farm and saying, you know, you've got some marijuana plants growing out in the alfalfa field, and you better, and it, they were just wild, you know, and so we're told to go and cut them down. That was a long time back.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the stories from, you know, farmers that just planted it because the federal government said, here, seed, it's wartime, let's plant it. And then we still have those genetics growing and dropping season by season, year by year. And the DNR used to spend a lot of money telling farmers they got to go cut it down.
Oh, man. Well, you mentioned various products. Delta 8, Delta 9 are made from hemp, mm-hmm. right? And derived from cannabis. How potent are these products?
It's interesting. So you have a set of these cannabinoids that are non-psychoactive, such as your CBD, your CBG, your CBN, etc. down the line. And then you have a group of them that are psychoactive, such as your Delta 8s, which a lot of people say is all the effects of cannabis without the paranoid piece.
Okay.
You have the Delta 9. Delta 9 is a tricky word because Delta 9, THC, realistically, they are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that a lot of the processing in our country that they figured out how to take Delta 9 or CBD, mix it with an isomer in a glass reactor and force the molecule to open up, kind of like a DNA human cell, and they know right where to stop it so it lands on Delta 9 and complete that synthetic conversion.
Oh, boy. So how is it possible? I mean, talk a bit more. How is it possible we don't have any laws in the state of Wisconsin regulating any of this?
So I guess it goes back to 2018. So we wrote the state law, and we gave those keys over to the Department of Natural, DECAP, Agriculture and Resources, Consumer Protection, and they ran the state program, but they ran the state program into a deficit. We were about $500,000 in the hole. So we chose in 2020 to turn over that state program to the USDA, and because of the USDA taking it over, the state of Wisconsin, I think they kind of look at it like this. We want DATCAP to give us some guidance and a little more enforcement, but we've turned over the keys to this commodity to the federal government. And if the USDA is handling the agriculture, typically in anything else, the FDA would have to step in and give us guidance on these type of products. And the FDA has not done that yet.
So, but you'd think the legislature would be interested in doing something.
They are. I mean, we've taken steps to try and get something to move forward at the level. We've worked with the Republicans. We've worked with the Democrats to try and move something forward to protect us. Because there's three sides to this industry, Larry. We have what we're currently doing. We have a group of individuals that believe medicinal cannabis is the way forward to take those next steps and I guess, make us be adults and mm-hmm. give guidance and SOPs and things like that to protect people. And then you have a group of individuals that want full recreational cannabis. But how do we move forward to medicinal when we can't even currently and regulate and protect what we're currently doing? Because that is a scary thing to think about, that some people call it the Wild West. I call it just, I guess, an opportunity for us to learn. When the bill and laws were written through 2018 through 2020, they were written in a way to allow the farmers, the producers, the manufacturers, and the processors to operate in a way where they felt comfortable putting investments into the state of Wisconsin. And that happened. That happened pretty bigly. And that's kind of how we got to where we are. They were left in a way to thrive our industry. But now that the industry is thriving and people have caught on over the years to what the federal government is allowing, you have a lot of money being spent out there trying to tell us how we should be doing it. mm-hmm. instead of listening to us as the farmers. Because the way what we're doing it right now, Larry, I'm able to grow something. I'm able to provide it to you. We are, as a group of individuals and businesses in the state, are choosing to self-regulate and guide ourselves by putting as simple as like alcohol and tobacco. Mm-hmm. If it's non-psychoactive cannabinoid, make it 18. If it is psychoactive, let's put a 21 age restriction on it. You know, that's a simple fix to make our consumers feel a little safer out there, I think, knowing that we're not just selling it out there. And we can get rid of that misconception, too, that, you know, children have access to this.
I'm wondering, I mean, you know, you saw, and I'm sure you are a principled person and producer and grower. I think there are a lot of people, and I would, you know, questions sort of a fly-by-night operation that comes around selling Delta 9 or Delta 8 or that sort of thing without any kind of oversight as to the quality. I mean, is Delta 9 Delta 9 or is it Delta 50 or something
yes.
like that? Yeah, understand what I'm saying.
Yes. So, I mean, in our industry, there are ways to test this material to know we are getting what we're getting and what we're producing is actually what we're telling you it is. You know, there's a thing called a five-panel test where they can test the cannabinoids, the micros. They can test for the heavy metals. They can test for any residual solvents that are left in there. So when you think about that, like when I farm it, the USDA comes and takes a sample to verify that the material is below 0.3 total THC. Then that sample is sent to a lab. That lab verifies the flower is legal. Then the USDA is happy, and you can take it then to the processor. Typically, when the processor receives the material, they should take a test knowing what they're working with, then process. At the end of that process, they should take another test verifying, yes, what we did for you and what we're telling you is in this container is that. Then that container should go to a manufacturer to put it into an end retail product. At that point, that person potentially will test it again to make sure that what they received in their facility is what the farmer and the processor actually said was in that container. They will produce their end retail product and then probably test it again. And everything through that process, most of these labs have introduced a QR code that you should be able to zap on any product. Takes you right to the testing website of the lab that verifies what you purchased that day is what it is, what it is. But the thing is, out there, those tests are very expensive. So a lot of businesses might be not doing it. You know, a five-panel test could cost you between $230 to $850, depending on what state and what lab you choose to use. And you got to do that four or five times in the whole process.
So you're looking at $1,000.
Easy.
Or easy. Or more to go through that whole. Well, so you don't have to. Then I'm saying you wouldn't have to do that.
No.
The way the rules are now.
No, not as of now. And you know, over the years, I've asked ATCAP. You know, I said, we as producers and consumers, we would like to see a little more regulation out there, or a little more guidance from them. And well, ATCAP always says, well, you got to go talk to your legislatures. Well, I go to the legislatures and say, ATCAP says I need to come to you and work with you on getting more funding and guidance and maybe write a bill to help guide them where they need to go. And they always say, well, ATCAP has the authority to do what they want. They just have to ask us for it.
So you have to go back to, so it's a sort of a circular kind of thing that's going on here a little bit.
Yeah. And I don't want to talk bad about either one. They're just kicking the can down the road maybe, or maybe they just don't know how to address it. I don't know.
Yeah. Philip Scott leads Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers. It's a trade group for the hemp industry, co-owner of Crone Apothecary in Madison, our guest. And you can join in with your questions or comments, maybe an experience to share. Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. taking a look at the cannabis industry here in Wisconsin and the lack of legislation or laws today about its use and about its manufacture with our guest today, Phil Scott. Philip leads Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers. It's a trade group, and they're trying to do the right thing here as far as setting standards and helping maybe come up with a law that would better enable them and you and me, if I wanted to use one of those products, be as confident as I could be using it. Adam in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Adam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had a listening discussion earlier on my drive, and you guys were talking about regulations, how the state's refusing to move on any of the regulations. In my mind, as a Wisconsin resident, it's always been the Tavern League that obstructs any progress on the CBD or the THC industry from taking off in the state. Just in the construction field, even hempcrete, stuff like that, that can be used from hemp products and can be bought from hemp farmers. There's a whole variety of different uses for it that can be. But once again, I think it's just the Tavern League in Wisconsin that will always oppose it. And then the legislators that are owned by the Tavern League, in my mind, are going to constantly just oppose any kind of movement, any kind of progress. Every state around us has moved on it except for Wisconsin.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Adam. Appreciate it. Well, Phil, comments?
That's a tricky question, but I do think that misconception with the Tavern League has changed post-COVID, like before COVID came around. I think they were a big proprietor against it. At least that's the way the community looked at it. And maybe if you followed the money, it might paint that picture. Or sorry, pre-COVID. Now we're in post-COVID. Post-COVID era, when we all started coming back out of our homes after lockdown, if people didn't realize, you started to see cannabis THC drinks start to pop up in your local gas stations, your local grocery stores. You started seeing them in every bar across the state of Wisconsin. And the Tavern League works pretty close with the liquor distributors. And if the distributors are making revenue off pushing that material across the state, I don't think that they're opposing it anymore.
So that, well, it brings me to this question about all of the ways that you can sell it or use it. So you, I mean, there's a lot of different products that come out of this.
Yeah, there's topicals. There, you can eat it any way, any form of edible. You think you can eat it, you can drink it. You know, the drinks are a little tricky because if I take your drink and pour it out and dry it out, and I test the sugar and your THC content left, is the dry weight basis of that material a true 0.3 total THC? It's a good question. Now, if it's a sugarless drink, might not be. So there's that kind of concept out there too, but you can smoke it, you can vape it. Any way you think you could do cannabis, they've come up with a way to do it. I mean, I saw a pretty cool product this morning that I didn't even realize was out there. It was a CBD-infused cough drop. Hey, here's a little CBD, you know what I mean? So
what would a CBD-infused cough drop do for you, or purport to do for you?
Well, the normal cough drop would do what it does, you know, obviously, yeah. Same effect, but the CBD might give you that little bit of pain relief that you needed, so you didn't have to take a cough drop and the ibuprofen. You've eliminated the ibuprofen, potentially. And I want to say this, too, just in case, you know, the government or anybody out there tries to use these statements to get me, everything I'm saying today is my own personal belief. I'm not making any medical claims on air today.
Okay. All right. Well, Audrey emailed us. She wonders if marijuana is legal in nearby states like Minnesota and Illinois. Can people buy marijuana cigarettes in stores like regular cigarettes?
If they're THC-enabled labeled cigarettes, you could buy them in that state and, yes, bring them back into Wisconsin because they are federally legal. But it is tricky. You know, you have Michigan that's legal with their own regulation and legislation. You got Illinois that does a little bit different, and Minnesota also does it a little bit different. Iowa even has a small two-family-owned business medicinal program. So we're the last one standing here.
Yeah. Well, what concerns me, one of the concerns I have is on this age requirement. I mean, I think there's at least one county that has passed an age requirement on it. But talk about this because I hate to see kids with young kids whose minds aren't formed having access to it.
It is tricky. You know, in our state, we went from Lydia's Law, which allowed with a prescription under Scott Walker's realm, mm-hmm. that opened up that door where if you needed access to at least CBD oil for seizures and that type of thing, you could get a medicinal note,
yeah,
you know, for protection. But right now, we don't have any age restriction in Wisconsin, and or I don't see any guidance coming from the federal government to set an age restriction at this point. So it's very tough. You know, I meet with our legislatures on a continue basis and remind them, like, if we're not going to move forward with food safety and things like that that we can enforce, can we at least do an age restriction on the material? Now, I will say this. I'd say about 80% of our industry, they're already doing this. We're not even told we have to do it. But we look at ourselves like the alcohol and tobacco industry. You know, we don't want the ETF someday to get angry at us and come raid us, you mm-hmm. know, that we were trying to prevent that. It is very tough when I go up to the legislatures and pitch them this idea, and they want to do it. It's just trying to figure out how to get both sides to do it. And it's very distraught, I guess, to the industry knowing that it's a simple fix.
Yeah.
It's a simple fix.
Make it 21?
Make it 21. 18 for non-psychoactive, which is like your CBDs, which is kind of like your daily aches and pains, your CBNs that replaces the molecule. For melatonin, your CBG, that's the all-around molecule that can adapt itself to anything, you know, those are non-psychoactive at all, you know, but the rest of them potentially could be. And there should be a restriction on them at the age of 21, in my opinion.
Yeah. All right. Mary Kay in Kenosha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I have some questions.
Yeah.
The vaping and smoking is definitely out, okay? But I wouldn't mind a drink infused with sparkling water, you know, a sparkling water drink infused with CDB, as long as it was marked where children couldn't purchase it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It makes sense. I mean, a lot of people in today's world are more cautious, especially with all the viruses and sickness and everything just going out there. They're really more cautious on how they're going to protect their respiratory system.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. You look at some of the products. I was reading a piece on how some of the gummy products, in particular, there's concern that, you know, they look like kids' candy, and the fact that a child could, you know, a young kid, 4 years old or whatever, could grab one and eat it and suffer some ill effects.
Yeah, I mean, that is out there. We see a lot of products that, you know, we see as concerned products on the shelf, the way they're packaged and marketing. You know, I don't think any of this should be packaged and marketed towards trying to draw the eye of a really younger individual, you know. I do believe that, you know, and it is out there, that packaging, and it has been talked about too. And the other thing that involves a lot of that is Wisconsin, we do have truth in labeling laws, you know, that does give DACAP some type of enforcement ability to say, hey, XYZ, we don't want to do that. And I don't understand why we can't lean on that type of something that's already there.
Blair emailed, what sort of laws restricting people from driving under the influence of marijuana or THC do you support, and how can these rules be enforced?
That's a tough question. I know that other states have done things for roadside testing and stuff like that. I don't support people smoking cannabis and going for a drive. I want to make that clear. Like, it's the same thing that concerns me with the drinks that are out there right now. You know, I can go into a bar and the bartender at some point can say, you're a little intoxicated, I'm cutting you off with alcohol. But when it comes to these drinks that are out there, there's nothing set in place right now to offer any guidance or protection. As a bartender, I don't know if I would serve those THC drinks to a consumer. What happens if he drinks two drinks and goes and flips his truck? Who's stuck with that liability?
Yeah, and let alone what happens to the person who flipped his truck.
Exactly.
So in those drinks, there's no alcohol in those drinks. Is that right?
Nope, no alcohol.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Peter in Montello has a comment. Let's go there. Peter, hi.
Hi, thanks for having my call. So I've been actually using some of these non-THC products recently as a substitute for coming from a state where it was legal. I'm a strong proponent to put age restrictions on these products because I had used THC underage when it was illegal. And I think that it's really important to protect children from being able to access these while still making them available to adults as almost a substitute for alcohol.
Yeah. Peter, thanks for calling. Comment on that, Phil.
No, I agree. There needs to be some kind of restriction and then approach that packaging front. And you know what? Like I said in the beginning of the call, too, like we have what we currently have. And what is that next step? And you know, a lot of people push for full legalization, but in order to set the SOPs, the standard of procedures, the good manufacturing practices that are needed to make sure a quality product is out there, we really probably should look deep into this medicinal bills that are being introduced. We have one by the Democrats, and really here in the near future, we'll probably see a Republican version of some type of medicinal bill reintroduced, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. So how does your tell us a little more about your organization, Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers. What all do you do? I mean, do you get yourselves involved in a little bit of self-regulation and so forth, and what else?
Yeah, I mean, and so in 2018 to 2020, we were big out and tried to get into the community and getting membership and everything like that. And then COVID came around, and we had to shut down. So we shut down for about 9 months to a year and kind of reevaluated ourselves in the industry of like, do we really want to be out there looking for money and this and that? I don't know if it's going to work. I think we just need to stick together as a good group of individuals in the state and volunteer our time, money, and effort to do the right thing. And that's what we've reevaluated ourselves as, more of a think tank, high-level group that is listening and communicating with everybody in all 72 counties in our state. And trying to make good decisions. You know, we did base ourselves off education and reform. And like we talked about before, mm-hmm. too, Larry, my job is to go out right now, listen to everybody, work with the universities that I've been working with to get grant money, listen to the farmers, listen to the processors, listen to the manufacturers, and listen to our consumers. Because without them, the rest of this fails. And we've done a very good job of taking data points, coming up with valid entry sheets to take to the Capitol and allow them to review this data and hopefully make educated decisions.
Andrew in Rhinelander has something. Let's go there. Andrew, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. You're welcome, and thank you for having this program. I appreciate it. Love public radio.
Thank you.
So in my experience, I fall into the third group where I believe it should be recreationally legal. However, I don't partake myself in, obviously, marijuana with high THC content, mainly because I have anxiety. And speaking to that point, I do use CBD, or I did, because that kind of helps alleviate my anxiety, kind of takes it down. However, I was on a trip, and I was in northern Wisconsin, like northern than Rhinelander, and I had asked for CBD gummies at this, it looked like a local shop, and I left the store, I bought them, left the store, didn't think about it. And one night, we were chilling at home, and I offered my girlfriend one, and we both took one, and it was not just CBD, and there was no warning, and it turned out to be, I believe it was Delta 9 in there, and man, that was, my girlfriend had never had any experience with this. So, I mean, that's, there needs to be more regulation on it, I for sure.
Yeah.
I have an idea, I think, to answer that question. And I agree with you. If it's labeled bad and that happened, that is a terrible experience and could ruin not only you, but everybody around you's opinion on the product. And that is, that's sad for, and bad for the industry. You know, one solution could be, you know, and I've proposed it to both sides of the aisle, maybe we need to create a cannabis control commission or cannabis control office in the state of Wisconsin. There's 29 parts to our industry. I've broken it down. I've been here since day one, seed to shelf, regulation, everything involved, banking, insurance. There's 29 parts. We need to have some type of control office in our state where a elected group of individuals, maybe it's by the governor, maybe it's by joint finance. I don't care. Let's figure it out. But there needs to be a group or office that can oversee everything involved with our industry so we can help make good, smart, guided decisions. And right now, that is not proposed in the current medicinal bill for the Democrats, and it probably won't be in the current bill for the Republicans when they introduce it. And that is a shame. DACAP has already shown us in our state that the hemp program, they let it fail, and they can't protect us. Why don't we have something that's outside of them that oversees everything cannabinoids, whether it's hemp, cannabis, marijuana, whatever anybody wants to call it? There needs to be something put in place to allow the check and balance to happen.
You know, as Andrew was talking, it reminded me about the Stoughton, the pizza place in Stoughton. Pizza Parlor unintentionally contaminated its pizza with THC oil. I think there were like 27 people were taken to the hospital for ingesting it was a psychoactive ingredient. What was your reaction to this?
It was bad. In our industry, we call it the Pizzagate. It was bad, you know, because especially for me, and like I've stated publicly before, it's all fun and games till somebody gets sick and die. And unfortunately, the environment that we live sometimes in our world, it takes a dramatic incident like this to open up the enlightening of what probably should have been there in the first place. And when I woke up and read that news article that was released, I really felt like we just took a left punch to the eye for our industry, knowing that the legislatures are already maybe be at the bit to find a reason not to move anything forward, and then this happens. I really feel like they might use that as ammunition against us.
Well, in this case, it was purely accidental. But again, it goes back to regulations. I'm thinking about the material that, and I don't smoke, but the material on a pack of cigarettes that warns or states what's there. Well, the oil, this oil that was cooking oil, I guess, from another outfit using the same kitchen. But there was no labeling on that oil.
Yeah, and like we talked about earlier, that comes in place to where having some set standards of procedure of how you produce and handle that material and then good manufacturing process, as well as you as the producer or the person that purchased that oil to use in your ingredient line should have the due diligence to mark that material appropriately. And knowing that it is a psychoactive material, maybe have it under lock and key. I was blown away that the manufacturer that has that material in an open kitchen with other businesses didn't take the appropriate steps to protect anybody else from ever touching it. And there's no guidance saying that we have to do that either. But sometimes common sense, I think, needs to kick in.
Yeah. I'm wondering about location, too, regulating stores, for example. Should stores selling cannabis products be required to locate some distance from schools?
So that's a tricky question, and I'm going to play victim here. So my current store is within, it's probably close to a school district line where I might not have to be there. I know where I'm located. They could not lease that place to a liquor store. They could not lease that place to those type of industries or tobacco store. But right now, there is no regulation saying I can't. So that is going to be a kicker that comes down the line for anybody that is in our businesses, whether you're a farmer, you're a manufacturer, you're a producer, you're a retail location. You're going to have to watch very closely, because when the state laws are written, are they going to say everybody has to move? Well, what happens to the ones of us when there was no regulation and we're open? Are we grandfathered in? Or is the city, municipality, unincorporated, are they going to step in and give us the grant ability to move? Who's going to be liable for all this shakeup that comes?
Yeah, I'd heard, distance is thrown around like 1,000 feet or whatever. But that would have an impact perhaps on you or others, certainly others as well.
Yes. Oh, yes, it will. And the thing is for me is I've been here for almost 3 years, and I have never had anybody under the age of 18 walk into my location.
Okay. Could third-party testing of products help set standards for potency and so forth? It sounds like there already is a lot of testing that gets done.
There is, you know, and we have a big influx of out-of-state products in our state, too, so it's hard to contest to what that looks like. You know, a quick little example. In the state of Oregon, they grow flower. If you send your flower into a lab in Oregon and you test it and it comes back with microbes in there, the lab has to tell the state automatically, like, that's contaminated material. So what these businesses in Oregon do is they'll send their flower to businesses in Wisconsin to get tested, because we're not mandated to tell the state of Oregon that their stuff's contaminated.
Oh, boy. Douglas in Loganville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Douglas.
Hello. Thank you for having this program. I just want to share a quick story that I won a holiday gift from a gas station where they had a number of different products in a drawing that I put in. And what I did was I consumed 600 milligrams of THC by accident, thinking it was an identical package of a sour gummy worm. And I assume it was Delta. But anyway, for 6 hours, I literally thought I was going to die. And my biggest question was the fact that it was so labeled so small on there that I could easily gave that package to my granddaughter. And so I went back out to the gas station and they said, yeah, we just sell this and it's not behind the counter with the liquor or anything else. And I'm thinking, how in the state of Wisconsin that can happen? So that's my comment.
Douglas, thanks for calling. Well, comment, Phil.
It is a very gray area that we live in right now. I do know that something does need to happen to prevent that type of thing from happening. You know, it's tough because even though it was very small written, it may have had all the stuff properly put on there to meet the truth in labeling laws, and I don't know. Because there's nothing overseeing that.
But if it's in the same area as candy or, you know, other kids' gummy type of thing, that should not.
Should never happen.
That should never happen.
Never happen.
Wow.
And there's nothing there to stop that from happening right now.
Phil Scott, our guest today, Douglas from Loganville, thank you so much for calling and sharing that experience. You can join in, too, if you have an experience to share or a question. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Larry Mueller here. Coming up at noon, we'll talk to three members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. It's a group of older women who have challenge public perceptions of protesters and personal politics. That's at noon today. First, right now we're talking about the consequences of Wisconsin's illegal yet accessible and unregulated cannabis industry. Our guest is leader of the industry, Phil Scott. He heads the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Group. Join in with your questions or experience. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. George sent an email. The guest, you mentioned paranoia as a side effect from using marijuana or marijuana products, which is a kind of a classic stereotype. Are there any myths about using marijuana you would like to argue against?
Well, I will say this. I have consumed cannabis on a daily basis for a long time in my life. I'm 35 now, And I do that to take my stress away, my anxiety, and my pain away. Most people don't realize I'm 16, 18 disabled on the left side of my body. I'll be walking and the whole hand and foot will go numb. Without consuming the cannabis cannabinoids that are out there, I wouldn't be able to live the life I live today.
So in other words, you're not going to argue against?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, this whole business, I mean, we've heard some experiences without regulation. How confident consumers be about the quality and safety of these products?
You know, as a consumer, if let's just take this hat off and say I'm just an average person and I don't know anything about cannabis and I walked into my place today, I would hope that my individual that is selling me the material that I'm looking to get relief from would have on the counter, I would go, hey, you know, can you prove what this is? And if they're doing it right, they're going to hand you a COA, a 5-panel test to show it's clean and a good product. And, you know, the ones that are using the appropriate labs out there now have the quick QR code that's as simple as you pick the product up, boom, the QR code, and it takes you right to the testing. Now, I will say this. It's easy for a lot of these end retail products that are out there to take that QR code and then send you to a website with a fake COA. So the ones that are doing it appropriately, when you click that QR code, it takes you directly to the lab's website that actually tested the material. Because that lab is holding itself accountable, pushing those data points out there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The whole business, you know, I think the self-policing part of it is, in the absence of state regulation, is there more that the industry could be doing to police itself? Or maybe talk, what is it doing to police itself and what more could be done?
You know, on our end, we're just trying to make sure that, you know, we're educating everybody involved of what a standard of procedure is, what a good manufacturing practice is. We're educating everybody that, you know, you might want to test that material and make sure it's clean. But a lot of this self-regulation comes to because we don't know what's coming and we don't want what's not here now used against us in the future. So a lot of our industry leaders in our state are starting to recognize, like, we don't want too much government oversight, because when you get government involved too much, it could become a mess. But we do want a little guidance for us as the ones bringing revenue to your state and investing a safety blanket. You know, we want to feel secure and make sure, like, we're protected, so we keep investing money into this state, as well as consumers keep buying that material.
Josh in Mount Horeb has a question. Hi, Josh.
Hello. Thank you. My question is about specifically why the farmers and the commercial growers for recreational marijuana or for these products in the deregulated areas or the areas that are not regulated, why can they not use or follow the controls that were established in the areas where the regulations are in effect?
Josh, I'm not sure I'm following you. You're saying what prevents farmers from following the medical marijuana regulations?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we don't have any set standards in our state that tells them they have to enforce it. You know, if, like I said, just do the right thing, and common sense does kick in a lot of what we're doing right now. Without not having any guidance in place to feel protected, we look at the other industries and go, what are they doing to protect themselves? So in order for us to feel comfortable and the consumers to feel safe, we're trying to do the right thing. Now, like I said, there is a lot of out-of-state players and a lot of out-of-state material coming into our state, and it's hard to hold any kind of accountability or enforcement on those materials.
Yeah, yeah. Josh, thank you for calling. Eric in central Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I think I just want to make a comment about the social and the communal aspect of it, as well as the kind of sacred experience of consuming marijuana or cannabis or whatever, what have you. And also, having traveled, I spent a lot of time in other parts of the country where it's legalized and a commodity, both recreationally and medicinally. And there's something I've noticed that has me kind of on the fence of whether I am for or opposed to having it legalized in Wisconsin. Well, one thing that I've noticed being in a place where it's legalized is it seems, it feels like my perspective of the experience, taking like the psychoactive and social perspective of it, is it feels kind of diminished where in a place where it becomes an abundant commodity, whereas in a place where it's not legal, it's a little more rare, and it seems to have more, for me anyway, it seems to there's a greater appreciation for it.
Oh, interesting. Comment on that, Phil.
Oh, I got a good one for this one, I think, Larry. So in a lot of states, it has become more corporatized and white-collar type of business, where in Wisconsin, being more of a blue-collar state and a little less regulated out there, it allows you to have access to good quality material. And when I say that, I mean the craft cannabis side of this, because mm-hmm. that is the big, there is two sides in almost every state you go to. There's the big corporate side, let's make all the money. And then there is the craft side that takes a step back and, you know, I might want to only grow my 20 to 100 plants and produce 10 to 20 pounds a year, and I'm happy with that. But those 10 to 20 pounds I produce are going to be some of the best quality material you've ever put your hands on. So I think that's where that comes from.
Interesting. Eric, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, just real quick. I'm not sure if it was covered much, but I'm hearing a lot of people with accidents, and it's terrible that accidents happen, but I'm thinking that the product is going to take most of the black eye, and where is the responsibility of the retailers? We're not talking about why are these retailers displaying it where these accidents can possibly happen. Let's regulate it. Let's tax the heck out of it, and let's try to eliminate as much of these problems and accidents as we possibly can.
Oh, Jeff, thanks for calling. Comment, Phil?
No, it makes sense to get some regulation out there and guidance to them, but I'd be cautious on the tax part. You know, there's a lot of commodities sold around the state of Wisconsin other than basically tobacco that might have a little excise tax on it. Right now, these retailers and everybody across our state are paying their 5.5 to 6.6% county sales tax. So the state and the counties are actually making revenue on the back end of this material.
So someone else was wondering, where are the cannabis farms in Wisconsin?
Well, that's a tricky one. Just like anything, it's a little quiet out there. They're spread out all across the state. I mean, the big chunk of the majority of them are probably in the lower two-thirds part of the state, and the northern part probably has about a third. So when you look at them, they're really spread out. They're, you know, we're not out there probably promoting where it is, because we do have a major problem with theft. I mean, if you want to talk about that, 3 years ago, somebody stole almost 140 plants off the edge of one of my fields. Law enforcement came and said, well, unless you catch them, I can't do nothing.
So you lost
I lost a huge chunk of change that day.
I mean, what would a plant, single plant, be worth?
It ranges. It could be $10 up to $1,100, just depending on the material you were growing off of it.
And you start adding 140
of them.
You're talking about a whole lot of plants. Well, I think it's been really interesting for me to talk with you today, Phil. And there's other callers online. I'm sorry we're not going to get to everybody, but I want to thank you for trying to shed some light and shedding some light on this whole issue. Sounds like we need some regulation. We need to get our local Congress, our local state Senate and Congress reps together to come up with something. And I want to thank you for being with us. Thanks, Phil.
No, thank you for the time. And like I said, we do need something in place, but we also need to currently protect what we have and give it a little more guidance so the consumers are safe.
Phil Scott leads Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers, a trade group for the hemp industry. And thanks to him. And thanks to you for listening. Coming up, we're going to talk with some members of the Raging Grannies activist group. I'm Larry Mueller.
grannies. We don't hide in nooks and crannies. We stand up for peace and justice, even when the police bust us. Join with the raging, raging grannies. Time to get up off your fannies. The world needs folks to take a stand. And that's why we're the Grands.
Okay, a little applause there for the Raging Grannies. That song is titled Grannies Stand for Peace and Justice, and it was sung by the Raging Grannies of Madison. Actually, it was on September 26th of 2024, and it was at the opening of the exhibit that we'll talk a bit about today with our guests. It's the exhibit's title, It's All the Rage, Activism, Aging, and Raging Grannies. And the exhibit's open until February 7th, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, we're going to find out about it today as we visit with three members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. One of them, Susan Bickley. Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
Barbara Park. Welcome to you. They're both in the studio. Thank you for coming by. And with us by phone, Bonnie Block. Bonnie, thank you for chiming in.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
As we talk with the three members of the group, I hope you'll join in. Have you been a part of the group itself? Have you maybe heard them sing at some event? What do you think about the group itself and about protests? I mean, this is kind of an activist group. What do you think of that, too? Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Barbara, maybe I can start with you and give us a little... This you're a Madison group,
right?
But you're part of an international organization. How did it all get started?
Well, it got started in Vancouver, British Columbia, with a group of women who were part of a anti-nuclear activists.
Okay.
And a U.S. submarine, nuclear submarine, came into the harbor there, So they rented canoes, these women, and went out to sing to the sailors as a protest to having nuclear power or this nuclear sub in the harbor. And they were not greeted well, apparently. They used fire hoses on them. So they came back again with umbrellas.
So they didn't have to kind of protect themselves from getting all wet, in other words.
Yes, yes. So so they formed a group called the Raging Grannies that ended up going across Canada and the United States. And I think there might even be some in Europe.
Okay. So what is the requirement for being a member? Is there an age minimum?
There is no age minimum. You do not have to be a grandmother. You do not have to be anything except against war and for the things we believe in mightily, which are that we all belong in our society and we fight for the rights that we have.
Yeah, we always say you have to be a woman of a certain age.
Okay. Well, Susie, when did you first encounter the Raging Grannies in Madison? What was your first impression?
Well, I was blown away. I had just finished a long career of teaching and editorial work and being a librarian, and I was looking for what's next when you retire, that moment of anxiety of how am I going to fill my time? And I went to a demonstration at the city-county building where a bunch of the most outrageously dressed women with hats and aprons and political buttons were singing about single-payer health care, a cause near and dear to my heart. And it happened that one of the members there was Nan Cheney, who many in our community here will remember as a great activist in the Madison community. And we had had our kids grow up together and go to the same school. And she said, "Oh, it's good to see you again. Would you like to be a granny?" And I said, "Well, how difficult would that be?" She said, "Well, you just have to come to the next rehearsal." And it was love at sight. And I have been an active granny since 2007. And I carried my Obama Badgers for Obama sign. And we've been together ever since.
Well, how do people generally react when they see and hear this group of older women singing? They're really unique, and we're going to hear some more of your protest songs, but I mean, what's the reaction?
Well, the place we see the public most is at the farmer's market, and we sing for the entire season at the farmer's market in a corner which now has the Belle Phillips statue in it. So we were happy. She was a Milwaukee granny, and many people don't know there are Milwaukee grannies, but there they are. And we sing right next to her. And of course, we get all kinds of people at the farmers market. We don't ask that people think the way we do, but we ask them to stop and enjoy a song which is heartfelt and about a whole variety of things, from the environment to women's health to anti-war to being in a just society. And we have a following.
Yeah, we have people who come and say, "Have you sung yet?" Have you, they'll ask for a particular song. "Did you sing the uterus song yet?"
And you have a whole catalog of songs, a couple hundred of them. Yeah.
We are about to add a new song, which I can tell you about later, and it will be number 191 in our library. our slogan is, "You got a problem? We got a song for that."
Yeah, we have wonderful songwriters in the group, and yeah, they can just come up with amazing stuff at the drop of it. If something bugs them, they write a song about it.
Bonnie, I want to get you involved. I understand you heard the Raging Granny sing at an anti-war demonstration, and you experienced how they changed the energy of the event, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was at that point a part of the Madison Pledge of Resistance, and a group of us went up to the event. And it was interesting because I get tired of speeches after a while. And music and humor really do change the energy. And I could just sort of see people being a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more ready to do something. And I was really impressed by that. It took me a little while after that. But my first granny gig was in 2003. And actually, again, it was on a bus trip to Chicago, and we participated in an anti-war event there. I really like the fact that we're out in the streets. And I think, you know, I've said this before, Reverend Jim Lawson was involved in the student sit-in movement and worked with Martin Luther King Jr., and he always said, "You do your best lobbying in the streets." And I think that's a really critical thing, because when you stand up in public, it's hard for people to ignore that, or for that matter, sit in or lay in, you know. Mm-hmm. There are multiple ways. I think it's critical, because people have to speak up. They have to be visible. And the powers that be don't like it, you know, which is why you often will get this ridiculous police reaction. But I think that, you know, if we don't go away, eventually they have to listen. Jimmy Carter, bless him, he had this wonderful line. He said, "What you need to do," and he was talking as a Christian, he said, "What you need to do is you need to do a good thing. You need to do all that you can, as much as you can, wherever you can, for as long as you can." Oh. And I really take that to heart.
Yeah. It's an excellent sentiment to take to heart. Joan and Hobart has something for us. Let's go there for a minute. Joan, hi.
Hi. I'm delighted that you took my call. I was a member of the Raging Grannies when I had a winter place in Tucson, Arizona. And my question is there a Raging Grannies around Green Bay, Hobart, Pulaski, that part of the state?
Ah, so is there
not sure.
The Green Bay area possibly, Sue?
Not as far as I know, but back in 2011, four Raging Grannies from Madison went up to Eagle River to meet with the most wonderful group of women who wanted to form a granny group up in Eagle River. And we worked for 2 days together to make costumes for them and get their hats with enough buttons on them to satisfy us. And Joanne Berner at the Many Ways for Peace Center in Eagle River hosted us for an evening in which the Madison Raging Grannies sang with the nascent Eagle River Grannies, North Woods Grannies, I think they called themselves. And the day after our first meeting, one of their grannies came in the morning with a song she wrote. And it was a song to the tune of Sentimental Journey. And it was about the war of Governor Walker on labor rights in Madison, for which we all know it was a very active time for pretty much everybody I know. And so we had great hope for that group, and we even sang that Betsy song at Bob Fest the next year. So we don't know of any group except the Milwaukee group.
There is one group just north of Milwaukee, but I'm not sure which town they're in.
One of the things, I mean, you guys have an active Facebook page, right?
Yes.
Which I actually went on it and took a look. And maybe, Joan and Hobart, you might want to post a comment or a question, and maybe you could talk Susie and Barbara, Bonnie, or somebody else to come up to Green Bay area and help you get one started.
Absolutely. I even tried to get one started in Alaska when my daughter was there. Some people came and said, could you start a group here? So,
oh, man.
It's sort of a nascent group as well that meets sometimes and not others in the northeastern Wisconsin, the Sheboygan area. And for a while there was a group in Green Bay. I used to live there for 12 years. And you know, I think it's ripe for a group. But the gaggles of grannies do come and go, too. It depends on, you know, how many people there are who can be active.
Yeah. Joan, there you go. What's your, if you just type in Raging Grannies.
Right, and
Raging Grannies of Madison.
Of Madison.
Right, and then it actually comes to me.
Ah.
So, Joan, I will keep your, I will keep a lookout.
Bob.
Yes, I will keep a lookout for you.
Okay. Joan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan Bickley, Barbara Park, and Bonnie Block are all members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. We got John and Eau Claire on coming up with a question. What about you? The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with three members of the Raging Grannies, decades of tuneful protest, I guess is a good way to put it, with them. Susan Bickley, Barbara Park, and Bonnie Block are all members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts, questions, or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@wpr.org. And now let's give John and Eau Claire a chance to join in. John, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Satire is such a lovely, lovely way to take some of the to take some of the emotions down on topics, like especially political ones. And my question was whether or not you guys avoid certain topics because they could become so polarizing, or if you avoid changing the words to any particular songs that might be offensive. I'm thinking like the Star Spangled Banner, for example.
Barb, you want to?
Well, we don't use that one.
Yeah.
But I think controversial topics we try to address with humor and with satire and humor, and you can get away with a lot of things if you keep it light and amusing. Mm. And you can still get your message across. As a matter of fact, people are more likely to listen if you have some humor and if you're a bunch of old ladies in funny dress.
And you are in funny dress.
We are.
Right. Yeah, we wear flowered hats and aprons and shawls. And, we don't look very offensive.
No, you look a little mini Pearlish.
Yes.
Mini Pearl type.
Well, yeah.
Sort of,
yeah.
I think the other thing that is really good is that we also poke fun at ourselves.
Yeah, Bonnie.
Along with poking fun at others or those in power. And I think that's important, too, some sense of humility of we're in this together.
I agree with you, Bonnie. And I'm looking at a copy of a Granny Peace song that we have been singing since 2009 about where the granny's trekking through and will move right over you with the Granny Peace Brigade. But the first verse actually says, our eyesight's growing weaker and our hearing's almost shot. Our breasts are slowly sagging and our figure's gone to pot. But the important thing is our voice is growing stronger and we will not be forgot. We're the Granny Peace Brigade.
I love it. Tim and Stevens Point emailed to say he got to see the Raging Grannies perform at the Musicians for Gun Sense event this past fall. And Jeff, I don't know if you've got that song up. Yeah, and I think it's to the tune of Bella Cho.
That's correct.
We are a country that has a problem. Too many guns, too many shootings. We ask how can we build a safer future? 'Cause we need to start right now. We are aware that thoughts and prayers, while kindly meant, don't prevent hearing pow. We need new laws that have some claws, and we need to pass them now. No more bump stocks or semi-autos. Make background checks universal. Do it now. We need to build a safer future. And we need to start right now.
There it is. How do people react when they hear that song?
Energized, I think.
I think so. And I think Deborah, who's our director at the farmer's market, especially she points out that there are more children killed by gun violence than by cancer. You know, it's the biggest thing that causes children to die. And that to me is just absolutely outrageous. You know, as a grandmother, it just, you know,
yeah,
infuriates me.
The raging, you know, just looking at sort of the range of songs, there's a suffrage song about taking up the cause of suffrage movement of the late 1800s. It's called Thanks, Susan B. Anthony. And I'm pretty sure Jeff's got a piece of that too. Let's listen to that particular song.
But what have we done with the rights they won for me and you? Do we vote, hold office, make them proud? Do you and you? Do we stand up strong and speak our minds the way this Anthony
And what's the reaction to that one, Barb?
It's always positive.
Yeah.
We sang that song at the Women's March in 2016 from the top of the Capitol steps with literally 10,000 people watching, and the women in the audience cheered and cheered for Susan B. because she did the right thing. And we have used that since because it's a real motivator. And if anything, we want people to vote. We don't tell them how to vote. We never back a candidate, but we want everybody to vote.
Yeah. Bonnie, sounded like you wanted to join in there for a minute.
Well, I think voting rights are critical. I mean, I think today it's January 6th, and after the, you know, in 2020 when we had the insurrection at the Capitol, it bothers me greatly that we try to use violence instead of using voting to bring about change.
Yeah. Susie, you marched in the 60s, back in the 60s, for the reproductive rights for women. And here you are. I'm wondering how it feels to be demonstrating for the same thing all these years later.
I am disheartened, but I am also highly motivated. It is intolerable that we fought in the 60s for rights. I grew up in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, you couldn't buy contraception unless you were married. You couldn't, I mean, we never used the word abortion because we didn't even go that far. We were really looking for basic rights and basic health. And it's shocking. It is truly shocking for all of us. I mean, our hearts stopped on the day of the Dobbs decision. It was truly unexpected that they could actually take these rights away after 50 years of women having the right and having care. And the aggression and the misogyny that has followed that makes it even harder to take. When we saw during all the last years since that decision how many women have died unnecessarily, almost all unnecessarily, trying to give birth or miscarrying and not being able to get care, dying in parking lots and bathrooms. I don't have words for it, really.
Yeah. You also, off air, you were talking, and somebody called, emailed, I think, from Arizona, who had worked for the Raging Grannies in Arizona. So that's they are involved in a different, well, they're probably involved in a variety of things, but you were talking about some of the work they're doing in Arizona.
In Arizona, I think the main cause for the grannies has been helping migrants who have crossed over the border and who are stranded in one way or another. They bring water, they bring socks because they don't have shoes and it's their feet are a problem. And those grannies have gone to jail for this time and time again. I don't have the details of who and when, but it's an ongoing struggle.
Let's switch our attention a little bit to Bonnie. You were demonstrating against U.S. drone warfare. And
oh, yeah. For 13 years, we did a monthly vigil witnessing against the drone warfare training and the housing of these unmanned vehicles. And I got arrested multiple times because whenever we just set foot on the base rather than being outside the gates, the sheriff was called, and we would get taken to be booked in Boston. And I did most of the time. It was, you know, it was a civil action, and we paid a fine. But on one occasion, I think it was 2014. Anyway, I and another regular vigiler, we took a public bus tour up the base. It's the only time I've gotten onto the base to see it. And at the end, you stop at the National Guard Museum. And we had a quarter-page leaflet to express the problems we saw with drone warfare in terms of most of the victims are innocent people of all ages, and that we shouldn't be engaged in this war on terror because it is a form of terrorism itself. So anyway, we went to trial on it, and we were found guilty, and I refused to pay the fine, so I did do 5 days in the Juneau County Jail, which was a very interesting experience because the ones on my, quote, pod were all white women, fairly young, and all of them had children who were in foster care. Only one had been convicted of a drug offense and was serving 1 year sentence. The rest were all there because they couldn't make bail. And it really showed me up close and personally what our mass incarceration justice system is like. And so, yeah, that's been a passion of mine. And we finally stopped because we were all getting too old and too few to continue the vigil. And I'm sad about that. But and actually, I want to share one other story about the abortion issue. At the farmer's market, there has been very consistently this past summer, and I think even before that, this young man who has a sandwich board sign that says, come to Jesus, abortion is murder. And we've all talked with him, and we have respectful conversations about how we disagree. But what is so funny to me is that when we sing our songs, and especially the If My Uterus Were a Gun song, he's tapping his foot along to the music. And I just think that is so funny, and it's another example of how music bridges gaps.
Somebody else is wondering, and maybe ask you all three of you this question: How do your families feel about doing this? Maybe even especially grandkids and so forth. Susie, let's start with you.
Well, my children are very supportive and proud, and they bring their friends to come sing us at the farmers market. We have a very blended family. We have gay people. We have trans people. We have, I guess, the same variety that many families have now. And when we sing at the Gay Pride Parade, I think our kids are really proud because so many of the people who are marching will say to us, I can't tell you what I would give to have my grandmother approve of what I'm doing. Mm. It's very powerful.
Yeah. Barb, what about you?
Well, my husband does of all of our technical work, runs our website. So he's very much approves.
And Bonnie?
Well, my husband, we have what we call granny groupies. And there's a big button that they can wear when, you know, we sing at events. My husband is very supportive and often comes, you know, to the farmer's market or to other events and listens to us. So that's great. And my grandchildren are both very supportive. They think it's great that I'm doing what I'm doing. And my son, too, for that matter. Well, one isn't so enthused. One is very supportive.
Okay. Well, we have a clip of the Raging Grannies performing the song The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. They were singing on the Capitol Square. I think this was recorded back in 2011 in August when this recording was made. So let's get a listen to the Money in Politics song.
Did you ever wonder why we keep on starting wars? Why poor folks' kids are sent to die while CEOs make more? Why votes are counted up by those who sell the voting machines?
It's 'cause
we've got a corporatocracy thanks to the Supremes. Did you ever wonder who will run for office since Supreme Court lifted limits? It really makes us wince. The rich will buy the candidates, and if you wonder why,
it's because
we've got the best democracy that ever money can buy.
Oh, man. Susie, in November, billions of dollars were spent on the presidential election campaigns. How do these vast amounts of money, in your mind, affect the priorities of the people elected?
Well, there's a reason why with every election we worry that tomorrow our health care might be taken away. There is so much money in politics thanks to the Supreme Court Citizens United, which says anything goes. And so now we are on the cusp of a corporatocracy, big time, maybe an oligarchy. We don't know what we're in for right now. But money in politics is where it started, and it's not helping us.
You know, what are the advantages, or what do you think advantage older women have as protesters?
Well, for one thing, we can get away with it. I mean, people listen because we're so non-threatening. I think people sometimes are surprised, maybe, that we're out there, but nobody is. Like I say, we're just so people are more willing to listen.
But nobody's going to throw a tomato at you at the farmer's market when you're singing.
No. No, they're very we get very good responsive crowds, and we're so non-threatening that people are that I think it makes it easier to hear when we're using humor and we're old.
One of the things I love at the farmers market and at other events as well, young women come up to us, and they are so excited about the fact that we're singing and doing this, and I find my hope a lot centered on young people, because I think, you know, the students that walked out of West High to demand gun control, I just think that is very powerful and very hopeful.
Yeah, what we've been doing a lot with the university students with this display the Helen B. White.
No, Nancy
Nicholas. Why do I keep calling it the wrong thing? And so we've been invited to some classes and stuff. And I think one of the questions that the students had that has stayed with me was she said, my grandmother doesn't think she needs to do anything for global warming. What can I tell her? Because we were singing climate song. What can I tell her that makes her realize that this is an important issue? I said, well, she may not be around, but you will be. You know, it's care for you, as not so much for her. So I think for the students, we're kind of a model of what they could be, what they could grow into, you know, that when they are older, that growing older is not a wall.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned the event at the Nancy Nicholas.
Right. If I get the right word, right place.
man, Susie, maybe you can tell us about give us the particulars of it, because it's still going on.
It is still going on. It's open until February 7th. And we were very excited about this. It came about through our relationship with Chris Garlow, who is a professor in the Gender and Women's Studies Department. And she has been teaching about the Raging Grannies for years in her class. And she finally revealed that she had been watching us for years and coming secretly to the farmers market. But she and Sarah Carter, who is the School of Human Ecology Executive Director, and a third person, Svea Larsson, who is a PhD student in Scandinavian Studies at Madison. So they have, the three of them, curated an exhibit of what it means to grow older and be an activist. And we got to sing at the opening. But they are not as interested in the politics of it all as they are in the items that go along with it. The stitchery, the crocheted uteruses that we wear on our apron, the decorations,
the hats.
The embroidery, the hats. So, but it's been a wonderful marriage of all of those things to create an exhibit. It's on two floors at Nancy Nicholas, the first floor and the third floor. And it was very exciting for me. I'd never been at a modern exhibit where every exhibit you could use your phone and use a QR code to get a granny reading you a story or singing songs or showing some of our gigs in the past. There are drawers to pull out, and there are hundreds of buttons going way back to from the beginning of our granny time. And samples of our hats, wearing all our buttons, and as well as live performances, which I think some of your music today was taken from live performances. So it's a wonderful exhibit, and it is still vacation time there, so parking will be easier, and there's a lot to see. There's even a cutout of two grannies where you can put your face in there and have your picture taken.
Oh, boy. Oh, talking today with Susan Bickley, Barbara Park, and Bonnie Block, all members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. Story to tell, question to ask. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with three members of the Raging Grannies of Madison as our guest today here on the show, and I hope you'll join. They're a protest group, but they use singing. They have almost 200 songs about about the broadest range you can imagine of topics and issues that affect us all. And it's great to talk with them. And I hope you'll join in again. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Ray in Madison called, couldn't stay with us. Ray is turning 94 next month, and he knew several former Raging Grannies, including the late Nan Cheney, a prominent Madison peace activist. How many members do you have in the, or I imagine this is not a, is this a dues-paying sign-up roster, or is it show up when you can, or how does it work?
It's surprisingly efficient, but we have no formal leadership. We have regular rehearsals. We meet twice a month for 2 hours each time, and there's no messing around during that time. We've got full agendas because we practice before we do any performance. And we have probably about 35 active members of the Grannies, but a big granny gig would be 20, 21 people, which is what we hope to expect when we have some important work to do. But there's no formal leadership. We don't hold elections. We don't have offices. We don't have dues. There's no financial buy-in. We are earnest. We're a community of women who care not only about the environment and peace and social justice, but about each other. And during COVID, the grannies were a community even when we couldn't protest and people walked together or Zoom together. But we care for each other. I mean, we're of a certain age where we are all vulnerable. Some of us are alone. Some of us have family. But you have the grannies.
And we call ourselves a disorganization, but really we're not, because it's just that we have roles that get passed around. So somebody is the presider of the meeting, so they work on the agenda and run the meeting. But the next time, somebody else does it. Somebody takes notes and somebody else volunteers to take them the next time. So it's not that we're not intrinsically organized, but we don't have a hierarchy.
So, yeah, it reminds me of a group I've belonged to for a long time that the one rule was that anyone suggesting that anything formal, rules and regulations would be immediately kicked out of the organization.
That's our kind of organization.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Kathy in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. And hi, everybody. I am one of the Raging Grannies of Madison. And I just had a quick little extension to the earlier caller who asked if there were any topics that were particularly, particularly touchy or difficult even for us to try to sing about. And yes, that is the case from time to time, the Israel-Palestine issue being one of them.
Sure.
But what we try very hard to do to solve it in writing our songs is to sing about the issue and not take one side or the other. In other words, you know, we're against brutality and we're against the killing of children and things mm-hmm. like that. And so what we try to do is sing about fanaticism as the enemy, not one side or the other side. And we also try not to sing about any one particular politician, but sometimes we fail at that resolution.
Kathy, thanks for calling. And
Kathy is one of our big songwriters.
Yes.
To give her total credit.
Yeah. One other song we have that is we've talked about, do we sing it with children present? Because it's written as though you're a 5-year-old and you're wondering about going to school and will you get shot today? You know, who will take care of me?
It's really a powerful song.
It is a very powerful song, but we worry about, you know, kids hearing it, because they are faced, you know, especially after the school shooting we've had here, you know, they're aware and they face these stupid drills and, you know, all of the stuff that goes with trying to keep school safe. So that is a tough one for us. I mean, we have the song, we do sing it, but we are careful.
Yeah, I have one other song we could play, and let's do it. It was at the opening of the exhibit, All the Rage. You sang. I don't think we've played this yet. Frère Jacques, to the tune of Frère Jacques, and it has to do with clean energy and pipelines. Let's go.
Okay.
Let's listen to that.
No more pipelines. No more pipelines. No more pipelines. No more pipelines. The power from renewables. The power from renewables. Power from renewables. Power from renewables. No more pipelines. No more pipelines. No more pipelines. No more pipelines. The power from renewables. The power from renewables. Power from renewables, power from renewables, that's the way, that's the way.
I'm glad you played that, and the reason is that we attach that song to talking about the Bad River Indians and their fight of the Enbridge pipeline, which is very much on people's mind around the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. They are the guardrails, as it were, for the whole Lake Superior, which feeds millions of people around the country, not just Wisconsin, for sure. And one of our members, Barb Arnold, has a son who is the counsel for their legal suits against Enbridge, and it is an ongoing and dangerous situation because the pipeline is now old and it has it was at one time buried, but now it is above ground, which means it's vulnerable to break or to be destroyed, in which case oil is going to pour into Lake Superior. So it's very much on our minds, and we try to bring that issue up wherever we go because it's ours. It's ours to fight, and it's ours to support them who are doing the hard work.
Samantha in Whitehall has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, this is Samantha. Yes. How old do you have to be, and what area, how far away do people come to be in this group? And also, there used to be a group in Trumbull County that called the Sizzling Seniors that would promote things and be in different like parades in the county for awareness for the Trumbull County and Wisconsin area. So I understand how important it is. And I'll take my answer off air.
Okay, thank you, Samantha. So do you have to live in Madison, or you know, how far away from Madison could you be to be still be a member of the group?
Well,
and aged. I guess age is not.
Age is, we always say you have to be a woman of a certain age so you can decide what that is. We have had people who we've had both mother and daughter in the group. And I'd say in terms of the Madison group, you need to be close enough to get to rehearsals because we really like people to be at the rehearsal prior to any particular gig so that you have a chance to practice.
Yeah, of course. And the rehearsals probably, do they vary, I suppose?
They're the second and fourth Mondays of the month.
Second and fourth, and does the location vary?
Between those two, but they're both near Central Madison.
Near Central Madison.
Yeah.
So, okay. So for our caller, if you're within driving distance and could show up a couple times a month to the practices, obviously you want to practice a bit.
But if you're not in that range, we can always encourage you to start another group.
Yeah. Nancy in Birchwood called to say, "You go, girls." Nancy says if she lived in Madison, she would be singing with you for sure. And Nicole emailed and identified herself as a Raging Grannies grouper. And do the Grannies have plans, something in connection? What's your next gig, I guess, is what the question is.
Oh, Saturday we're singing at the Capitol at 9 o'clock. It's a unity gathering, building unity.
Yeah, building
gathering.
Unity.
And we're singing at their kickoff of it. They have a 2-day conference there. And so we're singing for their kickoff at 9 o'clock in the morning at the Capitol.
There you go. Well, it has been interesting and a pleasure talking with you both, all three of you today on the show. I enjoyed it very much, and I'm sure our listeners did as well. So thank you, and keep going, keep singing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Susan Bickley, Barbara Park, and Bonnie Block, all members of the Raging Grannies of Madison. And as I said, if you go online to their Facebook page and you give yourself more of an idea of all the things that they do and all of the singing that they do as well. So thanks to them, and thanks to our team, Claire Neiper, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, our Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robin, Clara, and Joel are, of course, our producers. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.